Welcome to day four of our post-plenary press conferences. Today's plenary really had a focus on treatment scale-up, the link with health systems, and the role of people living with HIV and AIDS. And we had another excellent day, quite a dynamic set of speakers who are with me today. The first is Anton Pozniak on my right, a consultant physician, senior lecturer at Chelsea and Westminster Hospital, where he is the executive director of HIV research. Anton is also an executive member of the European AIDS Clinical Society and vice chair of the European AIDS Trial Network, or NEET. The title of his plenary was Advances in Antiretroviral Therapy. Our second speaker was Morolake Odetoyinbo, who is the Chief Executive Officer of the Positive Action for Treatment Access, a non-governmental organization dedicated to the promotion of the rights and well-being of women living with HIV in Nigeria. Also, she is an activist, advocate, writer, trainer, public speaker, television producer, and presenter. And Morolake spoke on the role of GIPA in strengthening health systems through the AIDS response. Our third speaker on my far right was Greg Gonzalez, who coordinates a program to educate communities in Southern Africa on AIDS and TB treatment and how to advocate for their rights to health care, which is administered by the AIDS and Rights Alliance for Southern Africa, based in Cape Town. As the only regional network on human rights and AIDS in Southern Africa, ARASA promotes a rights-based response to the epidemic through advocacy, training, and capacity building, and Greg spoke on ART scale-up. So I'm going to just a quick reminder again about the headphones that are available. You can ask questions in Spanish or English. We all have headsets, and I believe English to Spanish is two, though they sometimes switch to one. So each of the speakers will briefly make a few brief remarks summarizing their presentation, and then we'll open it up for questions. Anton?
Is the microphone on?
Yeah.
My presentation related to what changes there'd been in HIV therapy since we'd gathered together in Toronto in 2006. And I started off saying basically that the treatment works if you have access and take it all the time, and that life expectancy for a 20-year-old should be 40 years, and for a 30-year-old about 30 years, and that if you stay undetectable and have a viral undetectable viral load and a CD4 count that's over 500, the risk of you dying is similar to that of somebody who's age sex matched in the normal population. There are some issues still, though, in terms of life expectancy for drug users and for women. I then covered some of the other interesting topics that are going on in terms of antiretroviral treatment, which is when to start treatment, and there's a move now with the IAS USA guidelines for people to start treatment earlier. In other words, not just when their CD4 counts goes below 350, but also to look at people whose CD4 counts above 350 and individualize whether they need treatment. And the reason for this is there are benefits of taking treatment early in terms of tolerability, but we now know that people who are untreated, even though their CD4 count is high, can develop cardiac disease, renal disease, liver disease, and malignancies, even with a high CD4 count. So if somebody's at risk of any of these conditions, then perhaps with a CD4 count over 350, we'd start. I talked about some of the debates about what to start with, and obviously most of that is around access. And also I spoke to say that if you are in resource-poor countries and are on the standard nevirapine D4T 3TC type therapy and have virological failure, I know there are issues over how you might measure that, what to go to next, and really without much technology you could be switched in terms of a program to a boosted PI and a new class of drug, but unfortunately we don't have access to those sorts of compounds universally in resource poor countries. I then really finished off in a way by saying if you're on treatment, you shouldn't stop treatment, as we know from the SMART data, because if you stop treatment, not only do you run a risk of developing AIDS or death, but also these non-HIV related conditions, that you should start treatment really early if you come in with a very sick with HIV, which will again prevent you from progressing to AIDS or death. Some of the abacavir issues I also covered, but I'm sure you've heard a lot about those in the this conference, and they're going to be covered this afternoon. And finally, the public health message about treatment, the issue about will an HIV positive person who's got an undetectable load transmit to their HIV negative partner, and there's a whole session on that here, and I think there's got to be further discussion over this issue in terms of public health. And secondly, what they've described in Vancouver, that if you treated everybody you could who've got HIV and link it with prevention, would you have an impact on transmission of the disease? And finally, really, we do need good programs so that not only can we treat patients rationally in places where we've got lots of resources, but also treat them rationally where resources are scarce.
Thank you, Anton. I'd like to turn to Morolaki now, please.
Thank you, Craig. Thank you, Craig. My name is Morolaki Odetoyinbo. I live in Lagos, Nigeria. I work as a treatment activist. I work as a treatment educator. Today we talked about the role of people living with HIV in healthcare. And the first thing we established is that health system is everybody's business. It's not no one individual. It doesn't belong to the government, but it belongs to all of us. Some of us come from poor countries. Some of us come from resource-poor countries. But in reality, quite a number of us, my country, is really a resource-mismanaged country, not a resource-poor country. And that's because we have so many people who play different roles. Our governments, foreign, what I have chosen to call neo-colonialists, who come in under the guise of aid and under the guise of giving us aids and loans. However, it's really about dictating what should happen in countries and dictating our policies and sponsoring these laws that are not effective to us. People living with HIV have played roles and contributed immensely to healthcare systems. We are not just patients, we are not just receivers of services, but really we are the leaders when it comes to delivery in as regards HIV and AIDS, because we have taught ourselves, we have taught our communities, we have raised our voices, we have helped people understand what's happening. I studied dramatic arts. I have no science background. However, I have learned the science of HIV because I realized that that's what my life is about, and that's what we are teaching our communities, to understand this disease. So we played a huge role in healthcare. However, we should remember that in spite of all of this, women still bear the brunt of the burden. So we have our women who are still there, and they're still the beast of burden, really. Girls are also right now greatly disproportionately affected in terms of their roles as healthcare providers. Finally, we also need to understand that criminalization is harmful. In the work we do, we have taken the initiative. People living with HIV do not want to spread this virus. That is not our primary intent. That is not even our intent at all. However, we are having laws that are coming in, criminalizing even non-disclosure of HIV status, criminalizing spreading the virus, criminalizing a woman living with HIV who infects her baby. And these are really things that are drawing this the response back. However, for things to happen, it's important that greater involvement of people living with HIV, GIPA, should begin to mean greater investment in people living with HIV. So we need to invest in people for them to be involved. And people living with HIV should be reaffirmed, should be celebrated, and really should be respected for the work they've done in the community. Thank you.
Thank you, Rolaka. I'd like to turn to Greg now, please.
Good morning, everybody. I basically talked today about ART scale-up of antiretroviral therapy, and I reflected back on where we were 8 years ago in Durban at the International AIDS Conference when the first push for getting AIDS treatment to resource-poor, low- and middle-income countries started. And basically 8 years later, the point I tried to make is that ART Scale-Up is a health system success. It's the most ambitious public health undertaking of my lifetime, and it was something that was done against the conventional wisdom of the time. And that what we can do now is that 30 years ago we had the Alma-Ata Declaration of Health for All. We can take that and build on what we've done in AIDS and build towards a movement for comprehensive primary health care. For a lot of the talk, I talked about technical challenges, about infrastructure, about data monitoring, about drug supply, about task shifting, talked about choice of drugs and when to start, not just based on issues around what might be clinically important for individual patients, but what are the ramifications for national ARV programs. The way we've been able to scale up antiretroviral therapy over the past 8 years has largely been through keeping it simple. And there have been enormous pressures from researchers in the North and others to basically throw more complexities onto national AIDS programs, which would make it harder to scale up beyond the 3 million people we have on therapy now. And finally, I talked about some of the political challenges, the political threats to not just the ARV scale-up, but actually to push primary health care forward. Because some of the debates we've seen in the International Herald Tribune and the New York Times and the Financial Times and the British Medical Journal are repeating a mantra which is actually regressive and destructive. It says AIDS gets too much money, AIDS is destroying health systems, that the threat of AIDS has been exaggerated, and basically the rhetoric that's coming out of these people is not about how do we get more care to more people. It's about how to do less with less. And what I tried to say is that we're the heirs to Alma Ata. We're pushing ahead a progressive primary healthcare movement. The people who've been writing like Roger England and the BMJ are basically saying, let's do less with less. And if anybody's been around since the 1970s, remember right after Alma Ata, there was a group of people at the World Bank who said, you know what? This health for all is not a good idea. You need to have selective primary care. Let's do less with less. You know, and it's basically a Malthusian option saying, you know, we don't have the money to pay for health for poor people. But largely this debate is being led by people who have pretty good access to health care in Washington, D.C., and London, and other places around the world. So basically my plea to people in the audience is that we need to gather together as advocates for AIDS, for TB, for malaria, but also for primary health care and human rights to build a movement to make sure that nobody dies of any disease just because they're poor any place on the planet.
Thanks, Greg. I would like to ask one question to each of the participants before we open up. To you, Anton, on the clinical side of things at this conference, there's been quite a bit of evidence and discussion about HIV now being clearly a chronic inflammatory disease and HIV damaging organs of the body well before immunosuppression begins to set in, which has led to guidelines to treat earlier. I wonder if routine testing under circumstances where stigma and discrimination were not a problem. Routine testing was implemented throughout the world. Can you see a day where people would be treated immediately upon diagnosis?
Okay, so planning for the future, yes, if you could, that would be fantastic. But you need a drug that would have a fantastic side effect profile, in other words, none. You need a drug that was incredibly cheap. You need a drug that if you miss a few doses, it wouldn't matter. And you need a drug that if you're in any small village, in any part of the world, you could get access to. But first of all, you need access to that test. So is it a pipe dream? Maybe. Could it be a reality? It possibly could. I've been in this business a long time, as most people on the panel, and if you look at the achievements we got already, you know, we might get there. And I sometimes believe if you don't dream and try and pursue things, then you don't achieve. So realistically, no, but in my dreams, I hope we could do something like that.
Thanks, Anton. Rolake, could you give us any shining examples, if there are any, where people living with HIV are centrally involved in designing strategies, delivering services and managing them, engaged in monitoring and evaluation, in a sense playing a central role beyond the critical advocacy role that they play? Any best practices?
Any practice that takes in everything? I'm searching. Are there any? Well, let me speak for where I come from. On the continent, I haven't seen. where we have people living with HIV involved in designing, planning, evaluating in the entire spectrum. We have roles that for some reason we have been pigeonholed into. So people living with HIV would work as volunteers, would work as counselors, but really taking on the broad spectrum of things, it's a dream. It's what we want. It's what GPA means. It's what we want promoted, because that really is the idea, that we should be involved in things that affect our lives. However, we are still waiting to get to that point. If there are some, I don't know. I haven't seen them on my continent. No, I haven't.
Okay, thank you. And finally, Greg, you talked quite a bit about targets and the importance of targets, how 3x5, though it wasn't reached in time, the target itself helped galvanize the field to move faster. How would you see targets being set to reach universal access, and how they might link to strengthening primary care?
Well, first of all, I'm going to get in so much trouble, because I was at the planning meetings for when they set up the Universal Access Initiative, which was sponsored by UNAIDS and the Department for International Development. There was a huge fight in that room about whether we were going to have global targets. You know, this was just as 3x5 was, it was 2006, when was it, 2005, 2006? The French delegation, the Brazilian delegation, the civil society delegation, a bunch of other delegations argued we need global targets. That's what got the momentum going for 3x5. And we were told, no, this is going to be a country-driven response with country-developed targets. Well, let's go back and look at the data and see where we are. I think what we can say is that the global targets in 3x5 basically said to the world, we're all going to reach for a goal together. You know, do you know what the target is for Argentina? Do you know what the target is for Mexico? Do you know what the target is for Costa Rica? Do you know what the target is for Egypt or Botswana or China? None of you could answer that question today. It just obscures the goal that we're trying to reach. Now, if we're talking about primary health care, you know, we need to set a set of indicators. You know what Anton said about dreaming? We dreamed with 3x5. We didn't let the quote-unquote realists tell us it couldn't be done. We said we're going to reach 3 million people by 2005, and we were late a couple of years, but we did it. You know, we can do the same for primary health care, but we need to have visionaries who say, you know what, let's not, you know, take Bill Easterly and Roger England and let them guide us into the future, because they're pessimists. We need to be optimistic, set targets and milestones and deadlines, and reach for them. I think we can do it. I think we can really get 10 million people on antiretroviral therapy over the next 5 years, but it means really scaling up resources, scaling up commitment, and defeating some of this defeatism that has emerged among journalists, among the chattering classes in think tanks and in other places.
Thanks, Greg. I'll open it up now, and again, just say your name and your media house before your question. Larry first. Volunteer. Microphone's not working.
Hello.
You can close that.
Then
I'm happy.
Then the translators won't hear.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, can we get another microphone, please?
Microphone?
We need another microphone.
It's working now. Sorry.
It's working.
Okay, sorry.
Oh, great.
Dr. Pozniak.
Yeah.
Larry Altman, New York Times. It's a two-part question linked. Have the similar guidelines been written by European AIDS groups as the American one in terms of treating at 350? And two, has the committees that have written this, has that been scrutinized in terms of drug company connections with those who have written the guidelines to determine how much conflict of interest there may be and what would therefore be raising the number of people being treated?
Yeah, now, so let me just deal with the conflicts of interest, because I'm totally conflicted. I give a lot of advice to pharma companies and talk on ad boards, etc. But I'm very well balanced, because I usually give advice to all of them. I must say that all the people that are on guidelines committees have to declare all their interests, whether they're financial, whether they're non-financial, whether they're to do with relationships, family connections. So I also believe that everybody on the committee is not looking at any financial or political gain in terms of writing the guidelines. These are basically to help physicians and healthcare workers think about how to treat the patients. So the major issue when I call them guidelines is that's what they are. They are not a cookbook. They are not a prescription. They are guidance for people when they're dealing with patients, difficult choices about starting therapy, switching therapy. Have the other guidelines put this in? No, not yet, because guidelines take a while to revise. The British guidelines are still in draft on the web. The EACS guidelines have taken into account a lot of the data in the last 6 months, but they are renewed every 6 months. So the European guidelines this time don't include anything about much above the 350, apart from it's possible. But the next revision, of course, will take into account all the recent data. So in summary, I am aware of conflicts of interest, but I'm very confident that my colleagues sit on these committees and do a lot of hard work, spend a lot of hours for no personal gain except for the altruism of helping and trying to other colleagues and other healthcare workers, and also to influence actually some healthcare systems where we have influenced the fact that they would not fund certain treatments unless they were in the guidelines. And we have had to say we have got very good data that these treatments work, and therefore we put them in the guidelines. And without us doing that, some of the treatments would not have been available to patients today. So I think that's a really strong message from guidelines.
Am I correct, Anton, that the WHO antiretroviral guidelines for use in lower middle-income countries are currently under revision?
Yeah. I mean, the major thing about guidelines to say is that none of them are set in stone. They're always being continually revised.
Next question, please.
I have to speak Spanish.
Okay.
Please. Gracias, doctor Pozniak. Quisiera yo.
Doctor. Entiendo un poco.
Gracias. Quisiera yo preguntarle esta recomendación o este cambio de las directrices de que hace la OM, la IAS, perdón, para iniciar tratamiento en los 350 en 350 CD4. ¿Es porque la evidencia sobre los daños, como dijo usted, hepáticos, al corazón o renales, son muy contundentes o son muy frecuentes, o a qué se debe? Y en todo caso, ¿qué tan grave es el problema de los efectos colaterales, que sobre todo en los países que, dijo usted, tienen escasos medicamentos y no pueden cambiar terapias a inhibidores de proteasas más potentes? ¿Qué tan fuerte es este problema y qué tanto está afectando la salud, más que perjudicar? Digo, más que beneficiar a la calidad de vida de las personas que viven con VIH.
Okay. I think here that Greg has also addressed this issue, that the WHO guidelines have not yet come out on whether or not you should start earlier. The only guidelines that has suggested that might be the case have been the IAS USA ones, and I think that probably the European and the British ones and other guidelines will have something to say about this. So the issue is it what's the risk of starting early in terms of having the drugs? Are the drugs toxic? Will you get resistance? Will you get problems with the drugs? Well, the data only comes from cohorts, not from randomized clinical trials. They all suggest, the cohorts data, that there is a benefit from starting early. Now, I'm not saying we should all do this. I agree we should individualize, and that's what the IAS have said about looking at the patient's risks above, who've got a CD4 above 350, and if, say, they were hypertensive or diabetic or got heart disease or liver disease, you might think then that perhaps starting antiretrovirals would be better for them than delaying it. As far as people in resource-poor countries, I think it's still a major issue that those people who have got a CD4 below 200 don't get access. And if you had to grade it, who should get access first in a developing country? Obviously, those people at risk of progression to AIDS or death should be in the lineup first. So I understood, and maybe Greg wants to say something about this, that if you suddenly put this as a whole philosophy for the whole world, that suddenly you'd burden and stress out a lot of healthcare systems. So really this recommendation should be looked at on an individual patient level, not that everyone over 350 should start.
Greg?
Well, look, the question is about what's good for an individual patient and what's sustainable in a national HIV program. Tony Harries from Malawi said he's been under a lot of pressure to switch from D4T to tenofovir in the national guidelines. So, but what does that mean? It means basically that he can give ARVs to fewer people who will have fewer side effects, but saving fewer lives. So there's a balance between what is good for an individual patient in a situation like in the UK where you have a national health service, or in the United States where you have fancy private insurance, where you can pick and choose among any drugs, any test, going to any doctor. But if you're in Malawi, or if you're in Mozambique, or if you're in other places where the choices of drug are limited by costs, where the healthcare infrastructure can't bear a fancy lab test to monitor your liver enzyme levels or your kidney function, you're really going to have to think about this, about effectiveness, risks, and benefits on a program level from a very public health approach, which is different than what a doctor would do in London or New York.
Yeah, there's an old quote that the best is the enemy of the good. And I think that what we have to do is make sure that everybody gets good enough care at the moment. But it doesn't mean we shouldn't try and get rid of, in first line, some of the drugs which inevitably will lead to side effects. But that takes a lot of action from individuals all the way up to governmental support.
And just let me say here quickly that while we talk about side effects, you know, we all know that these drugs have side effects. However, if you come from the context where you are fighting for your very life, then you'd ask yourself, when people talk about side effects, ask from a person who has had AIDS and ask that person to choose, what would you rather have, AIDS or these drugs with side effects? When you know that you have side effects which can be managed, your drugs can be changed, it can be treated, when you're fighting for your very life, the drugs are ultimately and absolutely important. So while we don't want to dismiss or discountenance the fact that some of these drugs have side effects, it's important that we realize that we're talking about fighting for our very existence and just remaining alive. So when we go on with the debate of the cost-benefit of drugs and side effects, looking at you fighting just to stay alive and be there for your children and keep your family together, it's not a very balanced debate for most people in my setting and in my culture.
Thank you. Question over here.
Gus Naismith from the Rutland Herald in the United States. Having been with grassroots organizations in resource-poor countries, I know the problem they face of keeping it simple, not only in treatment priorities, but in the reporting requirements to funding agencies. And that if some of those funders would actually just go to where these people are, they would see transparency and data that maybe not on a computer, but is very clear to the eye. Perhaps that's part of the colonialism you talk about, Roloque. But I know you're not a victim, but it affected me that you emphasized new colonialism, but didn't mention anything that I hear from my friends in Africa and parts of Asia about corruption, favoritism within their own countries, blockages in the bureaucracies, and stigmatization that prevents treatment and education to get to marginalized groups. So I want to give you a chance on that.
Thank you very much. I actually did say that looking at the problems we have with health systems, the very first group I mentioned, talking about our governments, and like I said, most of them are self-centered. Then I talked about even those of us within the system, and most of us, even if we're not active participants, the fact that we will keep quiet and keep silent when things are going wrong means that we're equally guilty. And of course, you have the third partners, and they are the ones that I unrepentantly called neo-colonialists, because when you see what happens in country, it's appalling. Now, when we ask ourselves and we say, looking at HIV and AIDS and looking at the response, what are the challenges we have on the ground? You talked about monitoring and evaluation, and it's true, you have one hospital working with six partners, all six of them expecting six different ways of reporting. I'm going to go and look at the Nigerian Global Fund grant, for example, where we lost a grant because they couldn't even report what was happening, you know, and you are looking at different ways of reporting and different formats for different groups and what is the national reporting format, and everybody just wants to claim figures, so you are having over reporting. If I'm working in this clinic, I need to report that I have given US PEPFAR money has gone to treating 10 people with ARVs. However, what else are you supporting? Is it just about the pills? And really, what is our criteria for monitoring? And what exactly are we monitoring? Is it the number of pills we are throwing out, or the number of people that we are able to really make a difference in their lives?
Thank you. While the choir practice continues, can we have the question from the middle, in the, please?
Trevor Cullen, Biotechnology News. Anton, you talked about the importance of having dreams. Do you think finding a vaccine for HIV will remain a dream or a realistic possibility?
When they first discovered the AIDS virus, I remember we all got very happy because we thought there's going to be a vaccine. And so in 1984, I was at the Middlesex Hospital in London, and they all told me, we'll have a vaccine in 5 years. Now, if you ask any vaccinologist today, they'll say, probably wait 5 years. So I'm waiting still, but I haven't given up waiting, because I think there's been a lot more focus on vaccines in the last 5 years than there has been way before that. Now, there was a very good plenary at CROI looking at the way that vaccine development goes, and I think that part of the problems with vaccine development is not only the virus and the immune system, but it's to do with funding, it's to do with innovative thought about vaccines, and it's to do with the way that some of the basic science should be translated into creating a basic vaccine. I still am very wary about some vaccine trials which have very limited targets for HIV, and we've had two important lessons from that, and I think that we've got a little way to go before really good vaccines are actually prepared for man. But you've got to then weigh up, how long do we wait before we test out some new vaccine? And the whole world is waiting for something that might be effective. But as I say, I haven't given up the hope that we will have an effective vaccine, but I'm not going to give you a five-year target. I don't know when that will be.
Another question? No further questions. Larry?
Larry Altman, New York Times. Dr. Pozniak, you said also that we need clinical trials to document the 350 or whatever number it is. So how do you balance that versus the recommendations that are going on?
Okay, so first of all, I want to reiterate the guidelines are only guidance. So there'll be many physicians and others who will look at the guidance and say, well, that's not for me. Or they'll say, I have an individual patient who, yes, the risk is there, and I think that I will start early. And there'll be pressure from patients as well, and advocacy and everyone. So they're only guidance. But what the guidelines have thrown up is a scientific question that needs to be answered. Now, cohort studies are pretty good, actually, if you've got lots of them. If they all lead to the same answer, you usually end up getting that answer from clinical trials. So what's happened is the Insight Group, it's an excellent idea, are going to do a clinical trial to look at starting above 500 versus starting below 350. So there's going to be a big separation of these people, and they're going to look at all these issues that I've discussed today. Also, there's a plan to do the same in Africa using slightly different cutoffs, because the above 500, less than 350 is not quite relevant to the situation in Africa, and I really hope that that gets support to go ahead. And then what will happen is, over the next 2 or 3 years, the guidelines, various guidelines, may all come up and converge to say the same sort of thing based on the cohort data. But then we'll have the clinical trial data, and the clinical trial data hopefully will be definitive and will actually tell us what to do in these situations. And that's what we really need, and that's why we're doing it. If you look at most guidance, lots of it's based on expert opinion and cohort data, but randomized clinical trial data is what we need today.
Greg?
You know, there's a great book called Overtreated in the U.S. by a medical reporter that talks about how the American health establishment overtreats people with lots of procedures for cardiac care, for back pain. There's a lot of expert opinion which drives clinical practice that necessarily doesn't get borne out by the data. So I think Anton's comment that we need a clinical trial both in the setting of the U.S. and Europe and in the setting of Africa to give us randomized clinical trial data on when to start is just absolutely essential. Otherwise, we're just going on an expert opinion, and we know from medical history that it doesn't always work out to be borne by the evidence.
Just to play devil's advocate as the chair, can you talk a bit about both of you, all of you? Cohort studies are becoming increasingly important. They're larger, better run, well-designed, give lots of longitudinal data that often we would need to wait many years for a randomized clinical trial to get. And in light of that, what it seems, looking at the ISUSA recent guidelines, is what became clear to the panel was that people who were treated earlier seemed to have fewer negative clinical outcomes, more sustained responses. People who stopped therapy had damage that was clearly related to the inflammatory response coming back. So, I mean, the question is, randomized clinical trials being the gold standard versus cohort studies becoming increasingly important. I guess, where's the balance?
So do we need clinical trials is a question. So the best level of evidence is a meta-analysis where you get all randomized clinical trials together. Then there's clinical trials. Then you have cohorts. Now, the interesting thing is, if the cohorts are set up very well, and there is one question to ask from the cohort rather than going on a fishing exercise, then usually they predict what the clinical trial, any randomized clinical trial does. And there was a very good report on this that out of 18 very well set up cohorts, 17 of them had the same answer as the randomized clinical trial. But the issue is they are. But while you're setting up cohorts to ask the question, we might as well, at the moment, now set up the randomized clinical trial to ask it even better. Mm.
And also, a lot of the cohort data is from the developed world, from Europe and North America. Also, you know, cohort studies, we can't get into statistical discussion, but cohort studies have an opportunity for bias that randomization helps to get rid of. And so we don't just rely on randomized controlled trials just because we want to be like, you know, sticklers for evidence. It's because cohorts have weaknesses methodologically. So that's why we're arguing for the data, especially in Africa where we don't have the cohorts to even guide what the recommendation should be.
I think the philosophy really for me is that we got to get on and treat people. We got to get on and get the healthcare system into place. And in the meantime, while you're doing that in parallel, do good research. And it doesn't mean you have to spend millions of dollars on doing good research. You can do good research without having to spend a large, large amount of money.
Thank you. Final question here.
Sorry, it's a late question. Jane Draper, BBC. Question for Anton Pozniak. I know it's not the main thrust of what you were talking about today, but do you have any thoughts about what Greg was saying about Roger England's views and some of those debates that are emerging?
I worked a long time ago in Zimbabwe from 89 to 91, and it had a really good primary healthcare system. I mean, I don't know what the situation is now, but I'm sure it's probably degraded. And I agree entirely about what's been said about the HIV influencing primary healthcare systems and using primary healthcare systems to deliver quality care in all chronic diseases. And I see the model that we have in terms of, you know, very hospital-based, expert-based, not being sustainable in any resource-poor country, really. It's got to come from bottom-up, and we've got to make sure that the resource and the energy are of the people involved go into strengthening primary health systems in all of these countries. Even in resource-rich countries, we are thinking about how primary healthcare systems can be more involved in the treatment of HIV-positive people, because it's up until recently been really the area only for experts.
You know, don't take Anton or my word for it. The Ethiopian health minister is here, the Lesotho health minister is here, and they'll talk about how HIV programs have helped to build up primary care in their countries. You can do things the wrong or the right way. The big problem with Roger England's critique is that, what about structural adjustment in the 70s? What about chronic underinvesting of health and development in the 70s? Those probably destroyed health systems more definitively than HIV programs, which have been around for the past 4 or 5 years in terms of, you know, providing medical care in terms of ARVs.
The big question we have at the International AIDS Society is, who is Roger England? Health Systems Workshop in Grenada, which you can Google, has very little information.
Yeah.
Our question is, what is Roger England's legitimacy? On that note, this will be my last press conference chairing. Tomorrow, for the closing press conference, Julio Montaner will be chairing while I chair the rapporteur session. So I just want to thank Karen Bennett and all of her staff, all of the volunteers, and all of you for your energy and time and passion this week. And I'll see you next time.